You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Before King Charles III has his historic coronation, we're going to look back in history at previous coronations with Sean Cunningham and Neil Johnson from the National Archives. Hi, Sean and Neil. Can you remind us of the history of the National Archives and the kind of records that you store?
The National Archives is a government department. We are the archive of government business over the past 1,000 years. So everything from Doomsday Book right through to modern government tweets and emails, a very rich collection of detailed papers about monarchy, about the law, about landholding, and about how those things are challenged and questioned in the process of ruling. So petitions or legal cases, and as well as everything of big importance to the country, wars and disasters and all the rest of it. So it's a good record of how the governors and the rulers of this country have kind of used the written record as a way of recording what they've done. So we're now based out at Kew in West London, near to Kew Gardens, but not quite. So we're in a purpose-built building with lots of storage space here. And we're moving, obviously, from the printed and the written record towards digital material coming in from government. A very small percentage is preserved for the future, but ensuring that is in really good condition in another 1,000 years' time is one of our key roles. And we also link to other archives around the country in England and Wales. So it's a kind of network of information about how this paper trail has been generated over the past 1,000 years in all aspects.
Way back hundreds of years ago, what were some of the traditions and celebrations that we would have expected when coronations took place?
Well, we started trying to look for the kind of balance of records that we have, because what we have most of is the payment trail and the planning side of it, and not a lot about the narrative or reporting. A lot of it's linked to the heralds, who kind of organised pageantry and made sure everyone was in the right place and all of the precedents were in place, so you didn't get people of different rank in superior sittings and that kind of thing, which will still be applied today at the coronation. And obviously the coronation is a key moment which requires the most magnificent kind of setting of royalty and monarchy in the public space. So there would always be a procession from the Tower of London through to Westminster Palace the day before the coronation. And then there'd be a ritual bath for the monarch before processing on foot from Westminster Hall to the Abbey. So the pageant of coronation procession the day before was the chance for the public to see kind of monarchy in person. And it would be where the clothing would be most spectacular. You'd have new knights of the bath from the late 14th century, that becomes a tradition where the monarch would knight a load of new knights and they'd have a role in the procession, but you'd see everybody dressed in purple and white silk and gold. The coronation procession is really important because it's literally designed to dazzle the citizens of London, and they'll spread that news out to the country that there's a new king on the throne, and boy, did they look like a king. Yeah, so we're all going to stay loyal. There's also the gift-giving side of it and gifting of roles. So as soon as the monarch announced the coronation, there'd be a court of claims set up so that people who had traditional connections to the crown could claim a role in the coronation based on their relationship, either through their estates or through a direct role of office, like the Earl Marshal. In the past, people could claim the right to serve the king his wine in his cup and then claim the cup afterwards. The ceremonial butler of England could keep all of the undrunk wine from the ceremony. Because those offices still exist, they'll still be able to make those claims. So it's a bizarre throwback to the sort of Middle Ages.
I think there's also the issue of people not necessarily wanting to attend, because in the pre-modern period, opposition to monarchy was a big part of the politics of the country. So the crown was insistent, very, very insistent, that people who were meant to be there showed up. So letters were orders, effectively, to attend were issued, and money was to be gifted to the crown. And this was quite rigorously enforced.
There's an awful lot of politics around things like the Wars of the Roses and the Civil Wars in the 14th century as well, where the coronation is really a reset as part of the resolution of some sort of civil conflict.
How did a coronation help resolve these conflicts?
A lot of it's about different rights to rule. So it's cousins claiming different rights. So certainly in the 15th century with Henry VI and Edward IV and Richard III, Henry VII, all being more or less related, but all claiming different rights to rule. and at different points they have to use their coronation to kind of enforce that change of regime. So there's an awful lot of politics put into these ceremonials to bring people in who might have been opponents, to offer them a route back to service and loyalty, and therefore to reward and a better political role. But also they would run a parliament at the same time as the coronation, so it's a good time to put the boot into their opponents if they so wanted, because it does set the tone. It does broadcast this idea that this person is fit to rule, especially if they've come through a period of warfare and they've won the crown through violence, like Henry VII did at the Battle of Bosworth. Crowning in the appropriate kingly and regal way as soon as possible brushes aside all these doubts about whether he really is the right person to rule or if he really has got the claim. You know, the ceremony with religious dimension, the very act of anointing with this holy oil, is a very powerful way of saying God endorses this person to be the ruler. It's a brave person who then stands against that, really.
Although we've been talking about how important it was for people to stick very closely to what's been done before to show they're legitimate rulers, are there any big changes that have happened?
Well, the biggest change we could see in terms of how people will appreciate it today is that change to televise it in 1953. Churchill was slightly worried about the whole ceremony being presented almost like a theatrical performance. He didn't think that the solemnity of it all would be preserved by the fact that the cameras were there. So it was quite a big thing when it was televised, but the appetite was incredible to get the footage. The film stock was actually flown to Canada on the night of the coronation to be uploaded and broadcast in America and Canada, you know, as soon as possible. I think, you know, and it was broadcast on TV as well in the UK, but there was only something like 1.45 million people with TV sets in that day. So again, it brought people together to watch the TVs and have street parties. It connected people in a remote but linked way to what was going on in London, going back in time. There'll be all kinds of different, very small ways in which they would have exerted their influence over this process, but I think binding them into that tradition is what it was all about for them.
Well, thank you so much, Sean Cunningham and Neil Johnston from the National Archives, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio to give us a history lesson in previous coronations.